You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
As Todd said, my name is James, and my wife Emily and I have been members at Providence for about a year now. For those of you who don't know me personally, which is many of you, I come from a family of six children, three boys and three girls. So that's right, I come from the Brady Bunch. If you have seen the Brady Bunch and you're wondering where I am in the lineup, I'm Bobby, just so you know. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's really not critical to the message today. But just for some personal background, I did come from a family of six kids, and when I was young, my parents got divorced, and that led to some really tough financial times for our family. There were times when I would look in the refrigerator and I was hungry, and there was really nothing but a jug of water there, and I hated that feeling. I drove a series of really old cars because it was the only ones that I could afford, and I consistently felt the threat of those cars breaking down on me, because they would. And I hated that feeling. I hated it. And as I grew up, I became determined never to feel these things again. And the solution seemed to be wealth. And so I put wealth on a pedestal. And the funny thing about wealth is the world around you will applaud you in that pursuit. It'll applaud you in the pursuit, and it'll praise you when you get it. And I am convinced that I could have lived my entire life on that trajectory. I could have been consumed by it. And the world around me would have applauded me all the way to my grave. Well, what happened was, is in my early 20s, I got a new perspective. And what happened was, is I got to know God. And I'd like to repeat that because I got to know God. I got to know that he was actually real. See, because I'd believed in God my entire life. I actually believed he was there. But I didn't know him. And once I got to know him and know that he had a larger plan, that changed my perspective of everything around me. That is what this author is talking about today in this psalm. He's long recognized the power of wealth in the world, but his perspective of wealth and its ultimate power has been shaken up, and he's communicating about what's been revealed to him. In short, the author comes to an understanding of where lasting power resides. See, wealth has power, but it also has limits. He comes to see those limits, and he discovers where true power resides. I encourage you to keep your Bibles open or open them if you haven't, or pull it up on your phones or devices so we can go through this together. I'm going to be reading from the NIV. But you'll see as you look at this psalm that the author has split this up into three very distinct parts. He has an introduction from verses 1 through 4. He goes into a first point from 5 through 12, and then he makes his last point in verses 13 through 20. Now, the introduction, I'm not going to pay much attention to, but I don't want to ignore it completely, so I'd like to read it, verses 1 through 4 again. "Hear this, all you peoples. Listen, all who live in this world, both low and high, rich and poor alike. My mouth will speak words of wisdom. The utterance of my heart will give understanding. I will turn my ear to a proverb. With a harp, I will expound my riddle." In this introduction, he's basically just saying, pay attention, because this is important for everyone. In fact, he's so excited about communicating about this that he's going to break out a harp, and he's going to sing about it. I am not going to break out a harp and sing about this. That's not a good idea. You would not want me to do that. But I want to take heed of what the author's saying here. He's saying pay attention. So what does he want us to pay attention to? Well, he makes his two points that are separated into those two clear sections that you can see. The first section, from 5 through 12, he's communicating about how wealth's power needs to be put in perspective. Then he dives into the last section from 13 through 20, and he realizes this critical reality that we should put our trust in God's power. So let's see how he does this. And we'll start from reading verse 5 through 9. He says, "Why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast in their great riches? No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough, that he should live on forever and not see decay." Notice in the first part here, he's acknowledging his emotional reaction to the here and now. He's asking himself, why should I fear? He's realizing that he's reacting in fear. And that his response to hard times, to uncertainty, as he's comparing himself to others around him who seemingly have it all together, his reaction is fear. But see how the author is stepping back and saying, wait a minute, why am I doing this? He's talking some sense into himself because he's realized that he's just put wealth and security on a pedestal and it's controlling how he lives his life. He realizes that the people he's surrounded by, they're too confident in their wealth and power. And it's distorting both their perspective and his perspective. So what's putting things in perspective for him? He's recognizing that wealth and influence cannot save anyone from death. He's digesting the mortality of man and the reality that everyone is going to eventually die. And no wealth or power can stop that. And death puts wealth in perspective for him. That's a sobering realization. And see how he finishes this section. He continues in verse 10. "For all can see that wise men die, the foolish and the senseless alike perish, and leave their wealth to others. Their tombs will remain their houses forever, their dwellings for endless generations, though they had named lands after themselves." See, the writer realizes that everybody's in the same boat. Rich and poor, wise and foolish, we all share the same fate in the fact that we are all going to eventually die. So any perceived difference over the short term, any confidence the rich or wise might have, any feelings of insignificance that the poor or unwise might have, all of those thoughts are misaligned. Notice that it's almost as if he's mocking wealth's effort in the end when he mentions, though they had named lands after themselves. As if in one last-ditch effort for some kind of control over their own mortality, the wealthy and influential put their mark and title on the world so at least that lives on. Can we relate to this at all? What's the first thing that a president does when he leaves office? Typically, he builds a huge library, throws his name on the top to be there forever. Us in the middle class, we get to buy a brick from the university that we went to. We get to etch our name on that brick, and we get to put it in a wall or a walkway to be tread on by 18-year-old students for eternity. We do these things. It's just sunk into the writer that none of this matters over the long haul. It seems like it matters, and we get sucked up into thinking it's significant, but it isn't. Wealth's power is limited and it's short-lived. What does that do for the author? Thinking about death helps him shape his perspective on how to live. Why should he walk in fear when everybody seems to have it together and he doesn't? Why are the wealthy considered better than those who are not? The author understands that when he digests the fact that everybody's mortal and lets that really sink in, it changes his perspective on how important that looks and how important he makes that as he's living his life. Finally, he summarizes this new understanding in verse 12. And he says, "But man, despite his riches, does not endure. He is like the beasts that perish." He's just recognized that this new reality is a game changer on how he lives his life. You know, Christians don't have a monopoly on understanding that digesting our mortality helps shape perspective. I don't know if anybody here has listened to Steve Jobs' commencement speech that he gave to Stanford, but I'd like to read a quote from that speech. And Steve said, "Remembering I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life." I'd like to repeat that. "Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life." See, Steve found that by digesting his own mortality, it helped him shape perspective on the things around him in life. And it helped him strip away the things that seemed important, but they really aren't. Steve's not the only one who recognizes this. This is all over our culture. It's the reason why we have sayings like, "Live like you were dying. Live each day as if it were your last." In Psalm 90, Moses prays, "Lord, teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom." It gives perspective, recognizing that our days are numbered. And that reality impacts how we approach life and the people and things around us, if we let it. So what do we do with this? Just to make sure we have a common understanding, digesting our own mortality is not a fun thing. In fact, many times it's scary if you really let it sink in. It scares me. But allowing your mind to go there is a very effective way of gaining perspective of the things around us, things like wealth. We need to let our perspective be shaped by it. If we're wealthy, let it strip us of any titles or accomplishments that we have and expose what the real root of our confidence is. Let it do that. Let it shape our perspective of where we really line up at the end of the day against everybody else. If we're poor or just not wealthy, let it also expose the root of our confidence. And let it shape our perspective of the perceived value versus the real value of making our entire life's goal to achieve wealth and influence. We need to let it do that. It's easy to get off track if we don't gain perspective. I got off track. And I still get off track sometimes when I take my eyes off the bigger picture. The author was able to break free from that happening in his own life, and he was able to regain perspective. That's what's happening in this first section here. He's regaining perspective. We need to let the same thing happen to us. So that's the author's first big revelation, that we need to put wealth's power in perspective. Let's take a look at what he realizes next. And I love how the author starts this section off by, let's read here in verse 13, only 13 now. He says, "This is the fate of those who trust in themselves and of their followers who approve their sayings." See how the author understands then, just like we do now, that if you have wealth and influence, and that's what you put your trust in, you're going to be surrounded by an entourage of people who are going to encourage that journey and want to come along for the ride. He's basically saying that you're going to have a group of yes men that follow you around and support the thought that you're in control and that you've got it figured out, regardless of where that might lead you. Well, where does that ride lead us if we go down that road? Let's read in verse 14. He says, "Like sheep, they are destined for the grave, and death will feed on them. The upright will rule over them in the morning. Their forms will decay in the grave, far from their princely mansions. That is a really harsh reality check. What he's recognizing here is that with wealth, many times comes confidence. You feel very much in control of your own life and destiny, and you can begin to trust in that. He's warning us against that. And what does he say happens to those who trust in themselves? The writer says that death will feed on them. That's terrifying. It's terrifying because it's something so easy to put confidence in. We'll be surrounded by people who are going to encourage it. And it's so easy to get caught up into without even realizing it. It happened to me just as a kid, reacting to hard times in my life. But the result is death will feed on you if that's what you ultimately put your trust in. Now, I don't know about anybody else in here, but I'd kind of like an alternative to that. So this is why we need to keep reading in verse 15. And he says, "But God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself." What's the alternative? Guys, God is the only one in this room that has the power to resurrect anyone from the dead. The alternative is trusting in God's power to save us from death feeding on us. Now, the writer did not have the privilege that we have now. He didn't get to see how God was going to do that. And how did God do that? Well, he sent Jesus. And what happened to Jesus? Jesus died. But then what happened? He came back to life. He was resurrected from the dead. In Colossians 1:18, it says when it's speaking about Jesus, he is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead. Romans 8:29, it says, he's the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. Well, if Jesus is the firstborn, then who's next? Who are those brothers and sisters? Guys, everybody who trusts in God's power to save them from the dead, by trusting in how he did that through Jesus to close that gap between God and man and forgive man's sins, when we ask who's next, that's who's next. That's what we should be trusting in, and that's what should give us confidence. That's it. Look at how he starts to draw this to a close in verses 16 through 19. He says, "Do not be overawed when a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases, for he will take nothing with him when he dies. His splendor will not descend with him, though while he lived he counted himself blessed, and men praise you when you prosper. He will join the generation of his fathers who will never see the light of life." Again, look at the writer's recognition of how we become overawed when others grow rich. He knows what the world trusts in. He understands what a strong influence and sales pitch it is. But it needs to be brought back to reality. The writer understands both the attraction and distraction of wealth. But he also recognizes that at the end of the day, it's powerless in the big picture. Not everybody comes to that understanding. You know, when I first graduated college, I got a job in New Jersey, and it was in sales. And as I started that job, it became pretty clear almost immediately that God seemed to be coordinating opportunities on a level that were beyond my abilities. There were just too many appointments that I was setting up where the timing on them was just a little bit too good. And these things were out of my control. Well, I wasn't the only person who started noticing this. There were people at the company that did too. And two people in particular. the VP of sales, and the owner of the company. Now, the VP of sales, his name was Todd, and Todd had previously owned and sold his own business, very wealthy man. I honestly am not sure if he was working just because he was bored. He didn't really need a whole lot. And Mark, who was the owner of the company, this is a millionaire, very successful man. He loved having control over his business and this environment we were in. He loved it. Both of these guys were very successful and wealthy men, in want of nothing. Well, one day, me and Todd, again, the VP of sales, we got out of a meeting. It was a great opportunity. Todd had seen me set a series of these up at that point, and the timing was perfect. The meeting went really well. And we got out into the parking lot, and Todd looked over his hood of the car, and he looks at me and he says, "Arnold, what is going on with you?" And so he knew I was a Christian at that point, and I knew these meetings were a little bit beyond my control by then. And so I looked over him and I said, "You know, Todd, I could tell you, but you wouldn't believe me." And he kind of looked at me annoyed, and he says, don't give me that God crap. That was his response to me. Soon after, on a separate occasion, I was in the hallway with the owner of the company, and we just got off the phone, and we landed what looked to be a very notable deal. And the owner had this huge smile on his face. His name was Mark. And he looked at me and he said, "You realize this doesn't happen. These meetings that you're setting up, landing a piece of business like this, this quickly, it just doesn't happen." Now, Mark also knew I was a Christian at that point. And so my response was similar. And I said, "Mark, I could tell you what it is if you want." And he just starts laughing. And he looks at me and he says, "You know, people have a lot of words for luck." That was his response. These are two men in need of nothing, very much in control of their own lives, very quick to disregard the potential of God working outside of their control. Well, fast forward 10 years. You know, I'd gone on to start my own small business, and I got an email from Todd one day, and the email said, "Arnold, God got a hold of me. You got to give me a call." There's a lot of joy in receiving an email like that. And I got on the phone with Todd, and I was able to start talking to him about how he started seeing God work in his own life and how his family started going to church. He was starting to get an understanding of God's bigger plan. That is an awesome conversation to have. Well, unfortunately, I didn't have the same conversation with Mark, because Mark passed away. He went in to have a dental procedure done, and it caused an infection that spread to his brain. And he passed away within a few months. To my knowledge, Mark, this man who was a millionaire, full control over the company and environment he was in, he was a brilliant businessman. I never heard him acknowledge this larger plan that God has going on, which goes well beyond these lives we're living today. I never heard it from his mouth. I'd like to read verse 20. It says, "A man who has riches without understanding is like the beasts that perish." Guys, you can have everything that this world has to offer, and you can feel completely confident in that. But at the end of the day, if you lack understanding of the bigger picture, it means nothing. It's all powerless in God's larger plan. So what do we do with this section? First, we need to understand that while those who trust in their wealth have people around them to encourage that perspective, they're not the only voices to be heard. You know that entourage that I was talking about that you'd be surrounded by if you trust in wealth? Well, the people who trust in God have an entourage too. And guess who that is? Look around you. Guys, the people in our church, the people in our GCs, if you're not from Providence, GCs are just small groups. We get together once a week, get to know each other, really dig into each other's lives. These are not nice to haves in this life. I used to think they were, but they're not. We actually need each other. I need my GC. I need you. Because so much of the world around us is pointing us towards something that will not last. And I know personally that gets me off track sometimes. And we need to help keep each other on track and in line with the truth. The last thing we need to take away from this section, and this is critical, we need to be honest with ourselves and ask ourselves, what are we really trusting in? You know, I pray when Mark was unconscious at the end there, he was unconscious for a while, that his brain was still working and that he was thinking about some of those conversations we would have in his boardroom where I was able to plant some seeds about God's plan. I pray that he wasn't trusting in his wealth and any influence he had in the end there, but finally submitted himself to trusting in what God ultimately did to save him from death. Because God's the only one who can. When we really digest our mortality, what are we putting our trust in? What's giving us confidence? This is something we all need to ask ourselves because there's only one answer that means anything. The answer is not because of any wealth or influence we've gathered. It's not because you can keep yourself healthy enough or young-looking enough as if we could escape death altogether. The answer is not because you showed up in church consistently. And it's not because you memorized scripture or successfully followed some moral code. What are we really putting our trust in at the end of the day to save us? I'm going to draw this to a close. You know, what I love about the Bible is it's all really just one big story. That's why there's so many common themes throughout it, because they're all in response to the same God who's been there the whole time. It's just one big story playing out, but it spans across many, many, many lives. In the book of James, this is written centuries after Psalms, he also talks about wealth. And he says that the poor should take pride in their high position, and the wealthy should take pride in their humiliation. Again, the poor should take pride in their high position, and the wealthy should take pride in their humiliation. That sounds strange, doesn't it? Taking pride in humiliation. You see, what he's getting at is what we've seen today and what we've learned today. It's the reason why the psalmist in the introduction calls to both the rich and poor alike. You see, the poor take pride in their high position because you can have absolutely nothing in this world. And if you believe in Jesus, God's going to lift you up and he's going to raise you from the dead. You see, and the rich take pride in their humiliation because they've opened their eyes. And although they were absolutely surrounded by distractions and encouraged in those distractions, they were able to look beyond the distraction of their wealth and power in the here and now. And they're so glad They were able to put it in perspective and didn't miss the whole point. That Jesus is the only one that can redeem them from death in the end. And what that does is that levels the playing field completely. It puts them on the same level as the poor. And they take pride in the fact that they just didn't miss the whole point. Regardless of our position or status, everybody in this room, we need to help each other stay focused on what matters. We need to not miss the bigger picture of what God did through Jesus, and that we'll be saved from death through him if we just trust in him. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.